It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The idea of sending a child with a severe food allergy out into the world is terrifying, knowing that an inadvertent exposure could send your child into anaphylaxis. Adults with severe allergies may have a little more control over their environments, but the danger is always lurking. And this hour, we'll talk about what it's like to live with food allergies, what research tells us about why these allergies seem to be increasingly common, and we'll also talk about the latest treatments. And my first guest today grew up in Charles City with a peanut allergy. He had several close calls along the way, but he is here today to tell the tale. Mike McGinn is on the line with us. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Charity. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for being here. And tell me, when did you learn that you had a peanut allergy?
Well, I was a newborn, told I was 11 weeks old when I had the food challenge done, which is basically a food challenge is giving your child a suspected allergen to eat and seeing what happens. I was lucky I was already in the hospital at the time for asthma-related issues. I got a Ritz Bit sandwich cracker and didn't even really get to chew it. I was clinically dead for over a minute, meaning I wasn't breathing, my heart wasn't beating, anything like that. So I'm lucky to be on life number two, but I don't care to find out if I have nine.
So what led doctors and your parents to do allergy tests at such an early age?
Mostly the illnesses that I was experiencing, asthma-related issues, pneumonias, sensitivity to other foods as well, clearly. So that led to the food challenge and obviously me finding out about that. And when I was younger, I was allergic to many, many more things. At that age, I was anaphylactically allergic to milk, tree nuts. I had my vaccines delayed because of an egg allergy. So I hit the full spectrum of food allergies indeed.
Now, food allergies, especially nut allergies, are very common today, and we've learned to cope with that in society. We've made some changes to classrooms and how schools run and airplanes, all kinds of things because of that. When you were growing up in Charles City, it was a little less common. How did you manage your allergies at school?
Yeah, so to my knowledge, I was the first person with anaphylactic peanut allergy to go through the school. You know, growing up, a lot of it was self-management. I would always bring a lunchbox with my own lunch in it. I would go and eat my lunch in a separate room. If there was anything with peanut butter on the menu, I would get to bring a friend in with me. And then when I got into the public school system starting in middle school, you know, my parents met with the administration and they decided we want to make this a nut-free zone. We don't even want to invite the risk of that. And they worked with me to, you know, make sure that I would be able to have a hot lunch option that would fit my, again, my other allergies that I had at the time. Now, I will say that I knew of other people at other schools who were in sort of the same boat with the anaphylactic nut allergy. And I will say everybody kind of has a different experience with that, goes about managing it in a different way. A lot of it is what you're going to be told by physicians, what an administration is willing to do, what lengths they're willing to go to protect you and, you know, sort of protect themselves too. And then honestly, how people respond to it. You know, is it not a big deal to not let your kids bring in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or, you know, have that as a standard menu option? Or is it? So
so was it definitely a big deal in your case?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I didn't have the smoothest go of it. A lot of people and their parents definitely felt like that wasn't something that they should have to compromise with. You know, retrospectively, I understand that.
But that's
not an exception.
That sounds like that was hard for you at the time. I mean, how did that impact you socially?
It was. It impacted me socially just in the sense that it invited some targeting and some bullying. And again, everybody copes with that differently. Everybody gets a different amount of that. It happens at different times. You could be a totally regular middle school, high school kid and be bullied plenty. So it's not so much that element of growing up was difficult. It was difficult because it was in such a targeted way and it was with something that I knew could kill me. It wasn't, you know, just getting pushed into a locker. It was fear of, you know, something being slipped into my food, something being pushed into my locker, et cetera. So
did people actually make threats?
Yeah, there were threats. I don't really want to go into too much detail about
sure.
that, but there certainly were threats. There was definitely targeted bullying with that. But, you know, ultimately, the school administration worked with me the best they could. My parents were really great about helping me through it. So were my close friends. And, you know, I got through it. And a lot of that taught me how to better look out for myself and how to better make sure that I was safe and that I was diligent in my surroundings and that I was aware. So in the long run, I think in a way it's kind of helped me.
The tests that are given for suspected allergies are much more precise these days than they were when you first got your tests. But
yes.
So what do you know now about how severe your peanut allergy is?
Well, you know, it's funny timing that you should ask. I just recently had it tested via blood. So you'll have blood drawn, and then that's tested to measure a specific IgE level response. IgE is the antibody that mediates the pathway of an allergic reaction. And when you look at the scale, the results can be 0.35 to 0.69 is a low allergy, 0.7 to 3.49 is moderate, 3.5 to 17.49 is high, and that's where you started getting into the anaphylactic range. Mine's a 39.1, so I'm very severe. It actually has gotten better than previous tests. I'm also very, very fortunate to only about 20% of people with an anaphylactic nut allergy, peanut or tree nut, ever end up outgrowing that. And I'm fortunate that in my early 20s, I've actually now outgrown all the tree nuts. So it's just peanuts at this point, but it's still definitely very severe. So I'm definitely, like I said, very aware, very conscious of what's going on. It's challenging still. To maintain the diligence to read every label, particularly as you start out growing new things and you maybe haven't been tested for a very exotic tree nut before and you encounter it. But I've been very fortunate. Really at this point, it's just the one. But it's still definitely very severe. Definitely still carry my two EpiPens with me everywhere I go. So it's something that I'm constantly aware of.
Well, and I was just going to ask you that. As an adult now, how often do you think you think about your peanut allergy on a daily basis?
Every day, unless I'm completely eating the same exact thing every day, it's every day. Part of being diligent is rechecking. So I do recheck ingredient labels. You know, you find out the hard way through life that you took on maybe more risks than you should, and companies change their manufacturing practices. Particularly anytime I eat somewhere different or I'm in a new place. So lately that's been more frequent. But yeah, I mean, it's something that's always kind of going on in the back of your head at a low level of just being aware, thinking about it, even just down to what are you doing with your hands. So definitely every day to some extent.
Do you eat out?
I do. Yeah, I do. You know, a lot of people have very different experiences with that. Mine is very much kind of looking ahead, calling ahead, asking first, and always asking to speak, particularly with somebody who's in the kitchen, somebody who's going to know, somebody who's back there. and really focusing on cross-contamination issues, because it's really easy, you know, for you to go into a restaurant and think, I don't see anything on the menu. It looks fine. I should be able to just eat whatever. But you don't necessarily know. You don't necessarily know what all is back there, what all the cooking staff has, you know, even been eating themselves. So best always just ask. You find places that are trusted. And the older that I've gotten, the more I've been able to kind of suss out, you know, when a restaurateur or a cook is kind of being like, yeah, yeah, it's fine. We'll make this safe for you. And when they really care and when you really know that you're going to be okay, even if there perhaps are nut products in the restaurant, you know, it's possible to be safe. It's possible to try new restaurants, try new foods. And that's really, really a big joy of my life, honestly, trying new things.
Right. Do you find that because allergies have become so much more common, are people a lot more open to making accommodations and maybe even a little nicer about it than they used to be?
Yes. And really, you know, you have to understand that everybody in these situations are still people. And the more you have to deal with something, the more comfortable you become dealing with it. So now I live out in the Raleigh-Durham area, and it's much, much more frequent. So you can kind of get a sense of where are the places that are like, nope, you know what, we're not going to worry about this. We'd serve peanuts. Sorry, it's not an option for you. And what places have seen so many different people come through. As a matter of fact, I called a bakery just yesterday and asked because I wanted to try a loaf of their bread. They were very, very great about it. They even said, you know, full disclosure, we have a jar of peanuts in the back that our employees will sometimes snack on, but we'll make it safe for you. So the bigger cities you go to tend to have a little bit more experience with it, again, just based on raw numbers. But the more people understand and have seen it, it's visible, it's something that they know is kind of out there, again, the easier it is to deal with it.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Mike McGinn sharing his story of living with a peanut allergy from the very first he can remember. He grew up in Charles City, Iowa. We're going to talk more about allergies, research, and treatments in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about food allergies in particular. They have been rising in recent years. We've also been doing a lot of research to help us understand them better in recent years. So this hour, we're going to talk about what it's like to live with food allergies, what the most recent research tells us, what the latest treatment options are. And of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Jay Brown is here with us. He's an immunologist with McFarland Clinic, an allergist in Ames. Hello, Dr. Brown.
Good morning, Charity. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we were just listening to Mike McGinn's story about growing up with a severe peanut allergy. And I'm sure a lot of what he said really resonated with you, things that you've dealt with your clients over the years.
Sure. It's a very disruptive medical problem to have.
And it is getting to be more common. What kind of an increase have you seen just in your practice?
Oh, it's fairly dramatic. We see food allergies all day long, and there's no question that the incidence has been increasing dramatically. A lot of times a grandfather will have the care of his grandchild and say, you know, this didn't exist when I was a kid. The grandfather thinking of his own childhood and will think that we doctors are all up in arms over nothing and
right.
Just hand the child a peanut M&M. This actually happened to me, just to show everybody that, see, this is overstated, and that didn't go well. I mean, it ultimately went okay, but it's a very common problem.
Since it has been increasing so dramatically, we're going to dig into some of the research in a little while, but what is the going theory? What are the going theories right now about why it's suddenly so much more common?
It's complicated, but there's really a wealth of data that the modern world in which we live has spawned a lot of this. So in the third world, where a child might be living on a dirt floor, you don't hardly see this. We know that other cofactors, pollution, tobacco smoke, play an important role in the development of allergies, not just food allergies, but allergic rhinitis and asthma, hay fever and asthma. But it's a very complicated interplay between us organisms and our environment. And oddly, the sterility of the environment probably plays as big a role as anything. Childhood illnesses are different. There's lots of data. Children, for example, that come from big families, that fifth kid in a family is less apt to develop allergies. Children that live on farms, as you'll hear about later, very exciting research in the New England Journal of Medicine has put, I think, the crowning touch on this hygiene hypothesis, the sterility of the modern world driving a lot of allergies. So,
well, before we dig into that, help us understand what's happening when somebody has a severe reaction. I mean, let's focus on the peanut allergy right now. What happens to someone like Mike when they're exposed to a peanut?
Yeah, the core of the problem is that Mike's immune system is responding to that peanut protein as though it were a parasite protein. So the cellular machinery that drives the allergic reaction is appropriately used in the third world fighting parasites, which oddly, at least oddly to an American doctor, we never see, hardly see parasitic infection. But parasitic infections cause more illness and death in the world than any other category of infectious agent. So viral infections cause less illness and death worldwide than parasites. So we have a very elaborate mechanism to fight parasites. And in the United States, in Iowa, we don't really have parasitic infections. And it's not us doctors that are to be thanked for that. It's probably more our plumbers and sanitation workers. We have flush toilets. And so that's been great for us. But when Mike is exposed to a peanut, the mast cells and eosinophils that are very powerful cells, you can imagine parasites are arguably our most obnoxious enemies. And the cellular machinery brought to bear on parasites is pretty violent. There's a protein called eosinophilic cationic protein that's been characterized as the single most toxic substance in our bodies. So when you have a worm, it's good to bring out the big guns. When you are eating a peanut, probably best if you keep that weapon holstered. That's essentially what's happening when Mike accidentally eats a peanut.
And what are the outer effects of that?
Yeah, there's a litany of them. Almost inevitably, there'll be skin manifestations. So people get hives. These are itchy welts, and they tend to migrate, not a fixed eruption. And it's a pretty brief episode. Either it goes well or it doesn't. But you wouldn't have a rash for weeks on end. So the mast cells are in the skin. The mast cells can be found wherever. You can think of the body as having a perimeter. So these cells are sort of laying in wait for the enemy parasite. So they're in the lungs, they're in the lining of the GI tract. And so when people are exposed to a peanut, hives would be expected, deforming swellings, which are caused by mast cells underneath the skin, something we call angioedema, can result. People's lips get huge. If you saw the movie Hitch, you may remember Will Smith with the enormous lips after eating seafood. People have breathing trouble. They'll wheeze and cough and get short of breath in the gut. They can get nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal cramping. When enough of these chemicals from mast cells and other mediators of this allergic inflammation are in the body, the blood pressure will bottom out. And that's the final event oftentimes for people dying of an anaphylactic reaction.
And there are emergency method measures that can be taken to reverse that. That's what we've heard a lot about EpiPens in the news lately because of the extreme high price of that. But so somebody goes into this kind of anaphylaxis. What does the EpiPen or a generic equivalent, what does that do?
It reverses the reaction, and there's an abundance of data that it is critical that those people get it and get it quickly. Time is really of of the essence. The reaction is going to be milder. There's going to be less of what we call a rebound reaction if we get the epinephrine into a patient. What we drill into the medical students and the residents and my colleagues who aren't allergists is epi. You give it until the patient gets better. It's not unheard of for a patient. I had a fellow stung by a wasp in Boone. I wasn't there at the time. I met him afterwards, but I think they gave him something like 7 shots of epinephrine. It was totally appropriate, and he bounced back perfectly. This is an interesting phenomenon. In most life and death circumstances, if you live medical life and death circumstances, usually there's going to be sequela. There are going to be consequences to the horrible illness that you may have had.
Right, that you've gone through.
But in the case of anaphylaxis, if we can bring you back, you're going to be good as new in all likelihood. That's not always the case. If your blood pressure is terrible for, you know, long enough, 15 minutes, then you may have damage from the lack of blood flow. But getting epinephrine into people is critical.
And it's an emergency measure that actually works.
It actually works. Interestingly, with food allergy, the GI tract doesn't work. And so giving people oral medicines in the setting of an allergic reaction, we do it. We tell them to take their antihistamines, but it's an afterthought. It's not the core of therapy. The key thing is to get that epinephrine into them quickly.
Oh, so an injection is key.
An injection is key.
All right, we're going to talk more about treatments and about our understanding of allergies in just a moment. I want to bring someone else into the conversation here. Mike Orlando has 2 daughters with celiac disease, and that means that their bodies can't digest gluten, which, of course, is a protein found in wheat, barley, and rye. His experiences as a father of kids with restricted diets led him to open a new restaurant. It's called Good and Free in Sioux City, and he's on the line with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And so with your daughters getting diagnosed with celiac disease, that was a major life-changing event for you and your family. What led you to think about then opening your own restaurant because of it?
It was basically, I would say, the frustrations with just the limited options and or the fear of contamination. It was really interesting. I was listening to your first guest. And some of the things that he's dealing with just resonated so much with what we dealt with as a family. And, you know, sometimes you just wait for something and you're waiting for more options and you just end up waiting. And we just wanted to maybe take action on it. And we saw that the food, gluten-free food, other allergies that we avoid here has really been improving. So we just said, I think we could make this happen. And we've developed some very good dishes here. It's very comfort food oriented. But we wanted to do it, and it's really been great. It's very rewarding to see just some of the people that we've had just so satisfied.
Well, and you're not just a gluten-free restaurant. You're also avoiding other allergens. So there are no nuts on
right.
your menu. What else?
Well, what we do is basically, and the doctor on the line could definitely attest to this, basically, unless the statistics have changed, there's about 8 primary food allergies that make up about 90% of them, and wheat, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, dairy, soy, and egg. And basically, we were able to avoid the wheat, which is where the gluten would come in. We're able to avoid nuts. We don't mess with fish at all. And then we have many dairy and soy-free options and egg, but egg is the toughest of the 8 for us in what we sell, but we even have separate fryers and separate grills to avoid dairy and soy. So basically that's what we do.
So you've opened the restaurant, what, a couple of months ago now?
Yeah, it was July 14th was our opening day.
And yep. I know that food allergies have gotten to be very common, but you have enough business to sustain the business given how very specific this audience is?
Well, the biggest deal of what we wanted to do was make sure that our food was good enough so that people that didn't even have allergies would be able to come to it. And there were some things we were very right on when we've opened this. The allergy community would support us, and they would definitely come, and then people would travel. It was interesting. Mike was from Charles City. We've had people coming from the eastern part of Iowa to come to our facility, and they say they made the trip for that. Not just for some other reason to come to Sioux City, but it's interesting. You know, I have said to myself as we've been doing this, I go, you know, if we can make it in Sioux City and do this, I think we can be successful anywhere and do this. And that was not my intent when we thought about this, but it's sometimes you think you could use a larger population, but we're doing okay. We're doing all right.
Tell me some of the things you've heard from people who have gone out of their way to come to your restaurant. What does it mean to them?
They love it. They love it. They just love our food. We get great reviews of our food. Our food is delicious, and it's not delicious for gluten-free food. It's just delicious because we made it good. If you cook your, for example, buns, a lot of people will complain about bread with gluten-free food. And if you make your buns in a special way and you have a higher product at the beginning, they can taste very good. It doesn't have to taste like some of the things that you'll hear about, cardboard, chalky, whatever, just too bready. You can make it better than what it is. And we do burgers, chicken sandwiches, chicken strips. I remember when the small business guy that I talked to well over a year ago, when we were talking about this process, he goes, "What are you talking about? Like tofu wraps and bean sprouts and stuff?" I go, no. People with celiac disease and peanut allergy, they don't want to eat like that. They want to eat comfort food, just like other people who get to go to McDonald's or anything. And they want to eat that way, too. And we wanted to provide that, and we have. I mean, we really have. We had a French dip special this week, and it went really well. The thing is, and I mean this completely affectionately, we get people, I kind of call them like the criers, and I mean that beautifully because I love it. It's what makes it just so rewarding is we get people that cry when they come in here to eat because we'll give them options that they never get to have.
Wow.
Chicken strips, cheese balls. It's great.
Oh, well, thank you. Just thank you so much for talking with us today, and good luck. I hope you can keep giving people that opportunity.
I hope so, too.
Mike Orlando is the owner of the new restaurant Good and Free in Sioux City, which is gluten-free but also allergen-free as well. We're talking this hour about the rise in food allergies. And with me, I have Dr. Jay Brown, an allergist at McFarland Clinic in Ames, Iowa. Peter Thorne is also here. He is a University of Iowa professor and head of occupational and environmental health. And we threw out the idea earlier, just a little bit of this hygiene hypothesis, the idea that maybe our lives have become too sterile, too clean, and that's one of the things that is leading to a lot of these allergies. And Peter Thorne, your research has really focused on that idea, although it's a little more nuanced than that. Tell me a little bit about the research that you've done.
Surely, I'd be happy to do that. Well, so yes, Jay did mention the hygiene hypothesis and this observation that cultures, Aboriginal populations from around the world have almost no asthma, very low rates of sensitization to common environmental allergens. And when people move from those societies to modern societies, a number of studies have shown they very quickly achieve the rates of allergy and asthma that we see in populations such as in the United States.
So that tells us that it's something about how we live.
Right. Now, there's been a huge amount of emphasis on studying the genetics of asthma and allergy, thinking that that might hold the key to trying to develop better therapies. What we are now coming to understand is that genetics doesn't explain even the majority of it, and that really that has a lot to do with the environment. But we're also learning that the environment can affect genetics through an epigenetic pathway. So it's becoming a lot more complicated as we begin to unravel more of how the immune system works. So we were very fortunate to land on a sort of a natural experiment, and that is that we have two founder populations, the Amish and the Hutterites, who emigrated from Central Europe, Bavaria, in the 18th and 19th century to the U.S., but they kept their agrarian lifestyles, and importantly, they have very similar genetic ancestry. So we've mapped their genes and compared them to all sorts of other cultures. And they sit right on top of each other for 50,000 genes that we look at. So we can study these two populations and know that the genetics are not going to be explaining the differences if we find them. And these cultures, these two societies have similarities. They live in isolated communities. They have large families. They breastfeed their children. They drink raw milk. They eat a Germanic-style diet, farm diet. And they don't allow indoor pets. And I mention all of those because those are important things that have been studied in the past and found to make a difference in terms of developing allergies.
Right. So this gives you really a control group so you can compare the two cultures side by side. And I want to ask you more about what you found right after we take a short break. With me,
great,
Peter Thorne, University of Iowa professor and head of occupational and environmental health. And we're talking about a tremendous research study that he's done, the largest ever done on the role of indoor endotoxin in asthma and allergy in the United States. Also with me this hour, Dr. Jay Brown. He's an immunologist with McFarland Clinic in Ames. And you are welcome to join the conversation as well with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about allergies. They've been increasing dramatically in recent years, in recent decades in the United States. We're talking about what research tells us about why that is. We'll talk about treatments for allergies and also maybe steps you should take in your own life to help your children possibly have fewer allergies. That's coming up in a moment. With me is Peter Thorne. He's University of Iowa professor and head of occupational and environmental health. Also with us, Dr. Jay Brown, an immunologist with McFarland Clinic in Ames. And Peter Thorne, just before the break, we were talking about your research where you've done a large study looking at the role of the environment that people live in and the effect that might have on asthma and allergies. You have these two groups of people who have very similar backgrounds genetically and also similar controls in their environment as far as diet goes and a lack of indoor pets. Tell me, in comparing these two groups, what is the major difference between how these groups live?
Well, the difference really is that the Hutterites live in large communal farms, and they embrace all the modern farming practices. So the children don't have exposure to farm animals early in their lifetime. Compared with the Amish, who many of us in Iowa are familiar with, how the Amish live. They live in single-family homes, largely dairy farms, using draft horses and not oftentimes with no electric power connected to the household. And so these are populations that have different exposures fundamentally to the kinds of environmental agents that we have learned from some past research might be important to protecting people from asthma. And the remarkable basis for this study is that the Hutterite children have an asthma prevalence over 20%. And the Amish children have a prevalence of 5%. So this fourfold difference is what really provides the basis for an interesting study. So we hope that by studying these two populations, it might point the way to the prevalence, the differences and the prevention of asthma in the general population. You mentioned earlier that we had done a very large study of endotoxin, the largest ever done, and that was a nationwide study of nearly 7,000 households. And endotoxin is a component of a certain type of class of bacteria, gram-negative bacteria. And we know that endotoxin stimulates the innate immune system. So earlier when we were talking to Mike McGinn and his peanut allergy, he mentioned a high specific IgE. That's an adaptive immune function where you have antibodies. Contrasting that is the innate immune system, which is our natural system that is designed to protect us against things like Jay was talking about, parasites. And so we thought that the key to this might be that the environment of the Amish might stimulate the innate immune system early in life such that it downregulates or turns the dial down on the adaptive immune system so that people don't develop these allergies. So this allowed us to do three things. We measured exposures to bioaerosols, or these biological agents, in the homes of these children. We measured their immune responses in their blood and their genes. And then we made extracts of the dust from the Amish homes and the Hutterite homes, and we exposed mice to those dusts by inhalation in an asthma model to see what the effect would be in these populations. And to cut to the chase, the mouse studies, we were completely able to recapitulate this difference in asthma between the Amish and the Hutterite in our mouse model by only exposing them by inhalation to the dust from these homes. So something in the environment was clearly responsible for this.
That's fascinating. And let's put some of this knowledge into action along with other knowledge that we've gained in recent years, because even in the last 15, 16 years, there's really been a dramatic shift in thinking about allergies and how they develop in the environment. And Dr. Brown, tell us a little bit about, as an allergist, I mean, what you feel you know now about both the hygiene hypothesis and about what being exposed to allergens does for us or not.
Yeah, this is actually an awkward subject for me because for the first half of my professional life, I was giving people exactly the opposite advice that I wish I would have given them. There was a notion that by shielding children with a predisposition to food allergies, the development of allergies, we would make them less likely to develop such allergies. And in fact, it turns out the opposite is true. We've stumbled into a number of wrong pathways along the way, and this is a good example of it. Allergists used to traditionally tell people that you shouldn't feed your child peanuts until they're four. Peanuts are, of course, an aspiration hazard, so you don't want to be giving toddlers or infants actual peanuts.
Right.
But peanut butter, we would say, don't be exposed to it. It turns out that early exposure favors tolerance, which is good in the case of a food. It's bad in the case of a parasite. You don't want to tolerate your parasite. I mean, you don't want to tolerate your sandwich. And so by giving a child peanuts early in life, we're seeing a lower incidence of food allergy. And that was a New England Journal of Medicine article published on British and Israeli Ashkenazi Jews. Again, the genetics were very similar. Right. The culture was different, and it's very similar to the study of the Hutterites and the Amish that we were just talking about. At any rate, children in Israel exposed to peanuts at an early age developed much less, about a third as much peanut allergy as the British children whose doctors were giving them the same unfortunate advice that we were giving patients in this country, which was to avoid the peanuts.
So, all right, if it's not being exposed to allergens is part of this puzzle, perhaps the hygiene hypothesis, living in environments that are overly sterile. I know that there's been research that has shown that having two pets in the home, for example, seems to be correlated with the development of fewer allergies as children grow. There are lots of different pieces to this puzzle, but the allergy, we're having this, a greater understanding of it, but the allergy rates continue to climb. Why do you think that is?
Well, there are a lot of factors. I think that with any luck, they're going to stabilize and maybe take a turn in the right direction. I think, again, these revelations are brand new, and now we're telling moms to let that child have a little bit of peanut butter in their food, even at 6 months of age. And I'm optimistic that will reverse a lot of this.
I want to get to an email here. This is from Melanie in Dubuque. My father-in-law and husband have a severe tree nut allergy. Our son started showing signs of it at 1 month of age, reacting to my breast milk if I ate almonds. He was officially tested at 1 year old and has the allergy. Is there any information or studies that show these allergies are genetic? Is it common to see a family line like this, that everyone seems to have the same allergy?
Definitely there are important genetics on this. So there's no question that allergic predisposition is a common thing. It's one of the reasons I became an allergist, is that I get to meet the family. I get to take care of the little boy, and then I meet his sister, and eventually, if mom can talk him into it, I might meet dad, and I meet cousins and uncles, and I take care of entire kindreds in my practice, and I enjoy getting to know everybody. But there's no doubt that there's a huge genetic predisposition. And it's probably because some of us, if we were fighting parasites, would do better. In fact, that's been formally studied, that if you're living in the jungles of Brazil, you are more resilient to parasites if you have this predisposition
for allergies.
So it's
an evolutionary advantage, but not in our environment.
That's right.
The other thing I would just add is sometimes we attribute things to genetics more so than perhaps we should. So I don't disagree at all with what Jay just said. But one has to remember that families tend to have customs and diets and environments that they live in that are common. And so it's sometimes hard to disentangle the genetics from the environmental exposures. And now especially that we're understanding how environmental exposures can change gene expression profiles to favor one type of immunity over another. And so it's becoming more complex as we learn more.
I want to talk a little bit about treatments. As our understanding has changed, I mean, your recommendations to mothers and fathers, for example, about how to expose their children to allergens has changed. How about treatments? Have those changed as well?
I wouldn't say strikingly with regard to the treatment of anaphylaxis. The EpiPen is still the cornerstone. The price has changed.
The price has ballooned in recent years. I mean, up to the point where it's a huge hardship for a lot of families that you're working with.
It's a profound problem, and it is not limited to the EpiPen. The drugs that I use to treat asthma are outlandishly expensive. People can spend $4,000 a year for one inhaler, and I don't have any generic inhalers. I think the reasons for this would probably require a whole nother hour or maybe a whole nother month to dig into, but this incredibly complicated healthcare system of ours is clearly failing my patients and their access to medication, much of which is life-threatening, maybe life-saving, the medicines can be.
So when you work with patients and talk to them about the precautions they need to take, I mean, that must be an incredible challenge because so often insurance plans are not going to pay for these medicines.
Well, more and more of my patients have outlandish deductibles. They pay the first $2,000, $4,000, $5,000 or $6,000. The insurance companies are usually boxed into covering the EpiPens, even though they're not probably happy about it, although the extent to which they cover such medicines varies dramatically from one plan to another. And this cost is a tremendous burden, and there are a lot of people who I think are to blame for this.
I've read about people taking workarounds with the EpiPen problem where they just buy epinephrine and syringes and you know, create an injectable themselves. Do you have patients who use those workarounds?
Yes, but it's not particularly convenient to be tapping on an ampule of epinephrine and drawing it up when you are becoming hypotensive and can't breathe and covered with welts or what have you. So the design of the EpiPen is a bit problematic. The needle is on one end, and the cap that you're to remove before putting it into your leg is on the other end, and so people get stabbed in the thumb. It's not a perfect system. Having said that, it's a whole lot better than drawing up the drug. Our patients are lay people, and that's quite a challenge for them to be tapping on ampules and pulling drug out in the right concentration, the right amount.
Now, I know that peanut allergies are one – it's an allergy that people rarely outgrow, although there are other allergies that seem to change over time. There are treatments, or at least talk of treatments possibly on the horizon, that would expose people with peanut allergies to tiny bits of allergen. There's a patch that may be coming out in future years. What do you see as far as possible treatments to help people overcome this allergy?
There's a lot of research being done on this, and when I go to the national meetings, what the speakers who are presenting these research findings always include in their discussion is, you guys, speaking to people like me, you in the audience, do not be doing this in your practices. We are not ready for that. And I'm inclined to agree with that, although I'm optimistic that time is coming. So most of us in the community are not doing desensitizations. There is a lot of encouraging data, but it's not that common for people to die of a food allergy. It's hard to put your finger on the numbers, but it's probably in the neighborhood of 500 deaths, maybe 1,000 deaths a year. And the concern is that if somebody were to die in the office undergoing one of these challenges, that you may have killed a patient that was otherwise very unlikely to die in the real world of that. And I'm very excited about that patch. the FDA has given some green lights to that process, and it's thought that maybe as early as 2018 that'll be on the shelves. Every time I'm told something's going to be out in a couple of years, you can multiply that by at least two to get a real realistic.
It may be on the horizon in the not-too-distant future.
So these are measures to treat patients who already have allergies and in some cases asthma. There are also public health measures on the forefront that would serve to prevent the development of allergies, and those tie more into what we were saying before with regard to the hygiene hypothesis. Hand sanitizers have been promoted big, and now the FDA is going to take them off the market largely because they aren't efficacious and they may actually be doing us harm. In the 1960s, mothers predominantly were boiling baby bottles and doing all this excessive sanitation. We now believe that that was a bad idea. And now we say, let your kids go out and play in the dirt. It might be the best thing for them to do. So I think we're going to see the developments not just on the clinical side, but also on the public health side to help us reduce this burden of allergy and asthma that from about 1980 to 1996 tripled among young children and doubled among 5 to 14-year-old children.
Now, there's a preponderance of research now that is telling us more about the hygiene hypothesis. What questions do you have, Peter, that you want to answer next?
Yeah, so with our study of the Amish and the Hutterite, we now know that the Amish exposure experience protects them from developing this, the allergies and asthma. And then we were able to knock out some of the genes in mice and show which genes are responsible for this, that are responsible for the immune signaling and this interaction with the environment. So now what we want to know is specifically what in this Amish dust is providing the protection. It's not just dirt. It's not just bacteria. But we think that there's certain organisms associated with livestock that are behind this endotoxin in combination with these bacteria. And so if we can understand that could then help us a lot. And, you know, it's not like everybody's going to have a cow in their household. But as we gain understanding of this, it may point to some preventive measures that we can take in the public health community.
All right. Well, Peter Thorne, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Peter Thorne is University of Iowa professor and head of occupational and environmental health. And Dr. Brown, it sounds to me like the cost of medication right now is perhaps your biggest concern. But what are you most excited about on the horizon?
Healthcare reform. I think that the research that Peter's doing and the opportunity to desensitize people to food allergens, I'm very much looking forward to actually curing some of these illnesses as opposed to simply managing them.
Right. Well, I certainly hope that happens. Dr. Jay Brown, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Charity.
Dr. Jay Brown is an immunologist with McFarland Clinic in Ames. We've been talking about allergies, research, and treatment this hour on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Dennis Reese. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.